Hello, and welcome to season two, episode six of the Dock Talk podcast with the Inland Rivers Ports and Terminals Association and my good friend, Captain Monroe with the International Association of Maritime and Port Executives. Welcome, my friend.
Well, thank you, Amy, and always nice to see you, and always a pleasure. I'm sorry we're so far apart, but that's the modern technology brings us all together.
Welcome to the modern age. We have
Yes.
so much to discuss today. There is so much happening in our industry, and I'm so excited to just engage with our listeners and let them know of all of the exciting things happening. So, Captain, I wanted to start off with some people making waves, if you will. So there's a lot of people maybe switching from here to there. Tell us all about it.
Well, one of the nice things I think about our industry, we've always been an industry that, in many cases, senior positions with ports have always been saddled with people who have political connections, but not necessarily expertise in the industry. And I'm glad to see that more and more we're seeing more people who are coming to the forefront, who are coming up through the industry. And a lot of the folks that are now in senior positions and stuff have got a long set of experience now. From your neck of the woods, Brandi Christian, who is a graduate of our program and was the chief executive officer at New Orleans, she is now the CEO of Patriot Rail over in Jacksonville. So that was very interesting. Joe Morris has moved from the port director in Boston to the port director's job in Fort Lauderdale. He replaces Jonathan Daniels, who went up to Baltimore. Poor Jonathan, he was up there what 6 weeks, and it was kind of weird. It was like he left the ports of Indiana, he wound up at Gulfport, they got hit by a hurricane, then they went to Fort Lauderdale, they got hit by COVID, then he goes up to Baltimore and they knocked the bridge down. So I'm beginning to wonder I'm beginning to wonder about what's chasing John around. But he's up in Baltimore now doing it. He did a great job with all of that that was going on. So we are seeing some changes in the industry, but expected, I think. But I'm very pleased to see that we have more people coming up through the industry who are in senior positions as opposed to the governor's uncle or the governor's cousin or something along those lines.
Sure, and my good friend Chuck Camp is now with the Port of Pascagoula on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. So I'm really excited to welcome Chuck over to the Port of Pascagoula. I think he's going to do great things there. So we also have really exciting news. Last week, the Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg, Mayor Pete himself, came to visit the Port of Rosedale, Mississippi. The Port of Rosedale, as you know, Robert Maxwell, the port director there, is a student and an alumni of the IMPE. He was just recently awarded a port infrastructure development grant to invest in the handling infrastructure there at the port. And so Mayor Pete, as he likes to be called, came out to the port to celebrate with some of the local stakeholders. And I was invited to attend. And I gotta say, it was so great to have Mayor Pete in Rosedale, Mississippi, this very, very rural, yet impactful port. And I just wanted to hit on some of this real quick on why it was so kind of cool, really, to see the secretary and his team come out in full force to really celebrate the growth at a rural community and ha that has such a huge impact on farmers in that area. Rural. And when I say rural, it's rural, man. The power that Robert is now going to have to move more cargo more effectively, more efficiently, increasing the throughput. But here's what I wanted to talk about. The ability now for Robert Maxwell and the port itself to attract new tenants to their property because they have upgraded and more modernized equipment, and now they're more effective and efficient with their handling is so cool. Where
It's a
we really kind of have to start asking some very serious questions to our administration, either this one or the next one, or maybe it's the same, I don't know, and I don't care, is if we're making these massive investments and improvements to port property, and now we're attracting additional tenants to our port property, we have to think about housing. One tenant can support, in the realm of 600 workers, the workforce, right? They have to live somewhere. They have to shop somewhere. They have to get their gas somewhere. We can't be expecting these tenants to hire from hours outside of the radius of where the property is, where the crux and the core of the business is.
Well, that's a big problem in a lot of the ports and a lot of coastal areas, and you have a lot of people who wind up, transiting quite a long distances in. And having spent a fair amount of time in Rosedale with Robert, who is an amazing port director, that community has really compressed over the years. They've lost rail service, they've lost a lot of other things and stuff like that. And now if they're coming back, which is great. I mean, they got a great port district that they work with down there. You're going to have to be able to accommodate those services and stuff. We stayed down there. When I went to see him, I stayed down there, and you stay a distance away from the port, because there's nothing right around at the port itself. It's farmland basically, and the community itself is really compressed. But that's a significant problem everywhere. One of the things that has happened in the course of time here is that the value of waterfront property has gone up considerably. And obviously, in the course of all of this, port areas have been gentrified. You have a lot of non-maritime uses sneaking in. And of course, the properties that are there are, the costs are going up considerably. One of the things that we need to think about in the port industry is not only are we able to give wages and do all the rest of it, now we're going to have to start thinking about how do we develop the resources, the human resources, to make it comfortable. Because as you know, quality of life is a key issue for retaining people. First we got to get them in, right? Which has been challenging in itself, and now we have to retain them. And the best way to retain them is really care for them across the spectrum.
Absolutely. It really brings to mind for me just kind of the scenario of if you build a new interstate, you also have to budget in the signage, the highway patrol, the on-ramps and the off-ramps. So just building the core or the main infrastructure piece is not enough. We have to budget in or start planning for some of these other components that make transportation thrive. So one of the questions that I asked the secretary is, what can we do to start working with the Secretary of Housing and Urban to and Secretary of Housing and Urban Development to inject these considerations into their agency? So whereas if you were going to build a new interstate, maybe 1%, 2%, 10%, I don't know what that number is, goes to budgeting for your signage, your patrols, your et cetera. Maybe we should be considering the same thing here with maybe port development. If we invest this much into our port development, maybe we need to be factoring in a certain percentage. Maybe it's a federal match, a funding match. Maybe it's a state match or a local match, but a match of the funding should be considered for housing, for the actual human development piece of it to support the capital and infrastructure improvements that we're making on the port property.
It's sort of like what the military did when they developed their thing. Like you look at America's Central Port, it's a nice wide expanse of industrial property, but right, it used to be a military facility, but right in the heart of it is that residential area, where people live right within the port boundaries. And so one of the considerations might be in the future, not just focused on warehousing and intermodal yards and everything else like that, but a district that's set up for people who are working at the port to live in. And that might be a great way to, encourage new people coming in, as part of the benefit package.
It's a prime example, but it's also a prime example of diversifying your income portfolio. So we have our industrial use over here. We may have our warehousing and our manufacturing here, but here we also have our residential. It's an excellent diversification of your revenue stream. So I absolutely love it. It also kind of reminds me of the Bakken up in the Dakotas when, the Bakken crude oil in a good way boomed, right? We had this economic development in regards to now we're drilling, and they had to bring in the temporary man camps that have now become, more permanent man camps. I'm not saying that we need to build a man camp in Rosedale, although I'm not opposed to it.
A man, whoa, a man camp.
They used to call them man camps up in
Oh,
the
well,
Bakken.
I know that, but I mean, there's a lot of women who work in
A
these areas too.
woman camp.
Yeah.
A woman, a
A
co-ed
woman,
camp.
yeah. A woman person camp. Let's be politically correct here.
A co-ed person camp for housing.
Okay, there you go. But you have a lot of things going on too in your neck of the woods. I mean, the port of South Louisiana, they've got new people there, and they're doing some expansion. You've got the New Orleans port, which is building the big facility down in St. Bernardville, or St. Bernard Parish, I should say. You also have Plaquemines looking to develop there. They have, what, 5,000 acres of property down there, and they're being driven by Maersk, whereas MSC is, sort of the primary investor behind New Orleans and stuff like that. So that's going to make a huge impact. Do you think two big mega facilities are going to be able to support all of the traffic and infrastructure necessary that has to be built along the Western River system?
Absolutely. We've been saying for many years that we operate under capacity and that there is totally room for more cargo, different cargoes, diversifying what we're, currently shipping. And those two big ports are very well poised to help support those additional cargoes. Maybe it's additional energy and fuel sources, etc. I know that that's been a hot topic. People call it alternate fuel sources. No, it's additional fuel sources, right? But those two massive ports really are poised well to build it if we come type of scenario where we have new tenants, new cargoes, and we've got plenty of green and brown space to build out for the expectation of additional and new tenants.
Yeah, and if the river system, of course, is it's pretty well utilized coming down to down bound, but it's going back up and returning. But yet, you look at Port of New Orleans, which is, like, for example, a major coffee importer and stuff, and they're basically competing with Prince Rupert up in British Columbia. With the rail network changing the way it is and everything like that, it gives them an opportunity to capture much more of the cargo that has been lost to the other components of the intermodal system. So I think it's going to be very positive for them. What are you estimating is going to be the environmental impact of the heavy rains and the flooding and everything that you've had in the upper part of the country? I know you've had a water shortage on the Western rivers, a lot of low water and everything. And last time we talked in episode 5, that was a major issue, right? But I'm anticipating now that a lot of that is going to be corrected with the bad weather that we faced, but it's all running down, the river.
So I live in the St. Louis area, which is in the Midwest, and what we like to say here in the Midwest is if you don't like the weather today, just wait until tomorrow because it'll be different. And it is. So episode 5, we talked about the drought impact that many of our rivers were experiencing, and today we're talking about the flood, and that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about the Missouri River, and here we are in yet another historic flood on the Missouri River. Now, I'm not ashamed to say that I like to shut my brain down and watch a little ticky-tacky here and there. And I will say that the Missouri flood is very prominent on the ticky-tacky right now. And here's what I love about that. People are actually engaging and learning about the river system, not just the river system, but its impact to local communities, its impact to the farmers, being able to get the farmers' agriculture product farm to market type of situation. But I also love the education piece that's coming along with this. So I've been following one of the Tiki Talkers that has a fourth generation family farm on the Missouri River, and she's talking about the impact that this flood has on her fourth generation farm. Unfortunately, there is some uneducated folks out there that just want to tell her, hey, this is Mother Nature, just got to deal with it. And she's like, hey, wait a minute, did you know we have an Army Corps of Engineers who is charged by Congress, authorized by Congress to manage the water that we are seeing? So, what's happening with the Army Corps of Engineers and their water management system that's allowing us to continually flood and flood and flood? So, here it is. We have a reservoir system on the Missouri River where we can hold back water that can either provide for a decent flow in times of drought, etc. But are we holding back too much water so that when there's an influx, when there's too much water, now our reservoirs are full and we have no choice but to allow the flood waters to come downstream? Army Corps of Engineers do better. What has happened? What changes have happened in the recent years? Here's what I want to say. For many years, we've heard about climate change this, climate change that, and you have to do this and you have to do that. But here's the sad truth of it. The Army Corps of Engineers is operating this river system and managing our water based on a master manual that was developed in the 1900s, has been revised in, I think, 2004. But now we've got climate change 20 years later, and you're still basing your river management services after a master manual. Like, either we agree with climate change and we want to do better and operate differently, or we don't believe in it and we're going to operate based on this 20-year-old revision of a master manual. Like, you got to decide what you believe in, right?
Well, we've been fortunate enough just to be able to react to many of the infrastructure failures and everything on the river system and around all of the ports, coastal and inland ports as well. And I think, like the Coast Guard, the Army Corps is overtaxed with responsibilities, and they've just got way too much to on their plate. And the even with the dredging nowadays, there's so much more demand on dredging, and everybody's got projects coming out of the gateway here. So the reality is, I think, like a lot of our federal agencies, they're just understaffed with talented folks and stuff, because it's the nature of the beast. My generation, Amy, is retiring. Your generation is the up and coming, and they haven't been able to fill those positions as quickly as they needed to. And the Coast Guard is a good example. I remember when you went to Washington, D.C., you were talking about the aspect of, what do we need to do here? How do we need to preserve some of our Coast Guard personnel and stuff for waterway safety and management and stuff like that? But I think that's across all the agencies are like that right now, is that a lot of people aren't going into government service, or they're finding it better opportunities in the private sector, or they're getting out. How many people do you know have retired recently? From the Coast Guard, from the Army Corps, and stuff like that. And so I think that's probably what indirectly impacts the fact that this waterway management doesn't get updated as quickly as it needs to be, no matter what you think the reason behind climate change is. And I'm sometimes take the unpopular stance that it's a there is a component of this that's a natural phenomena of the Earth shifting in its orbit, shifting on its axis because of the way magnetic north has changed, and the position of magnetic north. So I think there's a factor there, and I hear what climatologists are saying. Yes, we certainly do add to that, with pollution and carbon dioxide and all the rest of it, and of course China is the biggest polluter, far greater than what we're doing. But the reality is that, I don't know if there's one single solution, but you're absolutely right. We have to react to it, right? And if we're managing our waterway systems with older approaches, with older procedures and older plans, that has to be adjusted. And the
Now
question.
let I want to clarify real quick. I'm not a proponent of reactive management. I am a proponent of, and this is quoted on this Ticky-Tacky page, preventative care. Now it sounds like your solution to the preventative care is to hire more to fill this understaffing phenomenon that we're in. That does take an act of Congress. That takes an act of Congress for appropriate appropriations, adequate appropriations in order for the Army Corps to backfill those positions that could then look at how are we, managing the river system. So it sounds like solution number one may be in part to congressional action to adequately fund so that we can adequately staff and manage and operate, etc. But I do say the second part of this solution should be preventative care. It is an act of Congress. It will take an act of Congress. And I don't say that as a dun, 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 like a heavy-handed an act of Congress. No, it's an act of Congress in Water Resources Development Act, which is the main piece of legislation that is for is directs the Army Corps of Engineers and River Management Services for the entire nation's river system, because it is a system. What happens on the Missouri is going to affect the Mississippi, and what happens on the Ohio can impact what happens on the Mississippi and beyond, right? It's a system. So I do think that Congress needs to really pay attention. And if you're going to say it's because of climate change or this or for that reason, we have to look at how we're managing the river system differently. And it does take a piece of legislation and attention in the WRDA in order to direct the Army Corps of Engineers, because the Army Corps can't just willy-nilly wake up on a Tuesday and say, we're going to do things differently. It has to be directed by Congress
Well,
that
I
the
agree
Army
with it,
Corps
Amy.
can do
I
this or
certainly
that.
agree with that. I think the issue that you're facing is, when was the last time we looked at Congress and they ever paid attention to the ports or to the river systems? You know, I've been arguing for years that we need a comprehensive, intermodal transportation policy in this country, and we didn't have one. And after Harry Truman was president, and the bottom line is that we're always fighting on these component pieces. Pay attention to this, pay attention to that, and everything like that. And unfortunately, Congress seems to be jammed up with other important things like, the normal politics of Congress. I was very disturbed, and I knew about it, but it really kind of hit the highlight. We as the United States are not signatory to the UN Convention for Law of the Sea, right? And what that does is that it opens up avenue for things for mining, undersea mining, and all the other things that are essential. And there's a group of people who just basically say, no, we shouldn't be doing that because we're subjugating ourselves to the UN. Well, the thing is, Congress needs to get beyond that and make a decision. And it's the same thing with the river system. It's the same thing with updating. But if Congress threw a pile of money at it tomorrow, we don't have the people who are willing to step into these roles. And that is across the board. It is with the inland ports, it is with the coastal ports. And it is with the logistics chain in general. The shortage of truck drivers in our country due to electronic logbooks and the fact that Amazon is paying truck drivers more money to stay at home and deliver packages than long haul truck drivers are getting, on the roadway system and stuff. So I'm not exactly sure at this point why we have such a shortage of people. I really don't know. It just seems, and I recognize that a lot of us are retiring, but where's the next generation? Where's the rest of the people coming forward? I
You're
don't know.
not gonna like you're not gonna like my answer on this one.
Okay, go ahead.
Talk about controversial. That generation that we're trying to attract into the workforce today is a generation that grew up on big pharma, totally fearful of, the medications and the insurance companies. They grew up in an era where herbal medicines were acceptable and now legal. For consumption to treat a whole range of illnesses, including anxiety, depression, etc. Unfortunately, our lawmakers and our administration is not accepting of that herbal medicine route, and has said if you can't pass a drug test, then you can't work for us. And now we're wondering why we have a shortage of a workforce. So,
Yeah,
I'm
I
not
have.
saying I want everybody to accept a workforce that can't pass a drug test, but I am saying this is part of the problem.
Well, I agree. And because in my side of the career, from the day I got my license right through to most recently, I've had to have regular drug tests and random drug testing and everything like that. It was, and my state, in the state of Maine, I can go down the street and pick up, go to the recreational marijuana store, right? But if I got THC in my bloodstream, I'm done, right? And the fact of the matter is that what I hear, particularly in Charleston and the folks I work with down there, is that like Boeing or Volvo or somebody like that, they'll have this big call, for employee, and a lot of people apply, right? What's the first thing Boeing does? Says, okay, physical and a drug test. And a third of the applicants are gone right off the bat. So that has been a problem. There's a different work ethic, Amy, I think now. And I don't want to paint a broad brush here, but we need to also, as part of this, develop a way to encourage the next generation, right? The young people out there to recognize that there are good, viable opportunities in our industry, on inland side, on the coastal side, in transportation and logistics, that these are excellent jobs and stuff like that. And unfortunately, I see like MARAD, for example, has got some, workforce development programs in place and stuff, but they're looking at that seafarers, right? And they really, I think the maritime schools, as well as other po components of the industry, your industry folks, my industry folks, need to focus on, what about the kids in elementary school? I mean, we help and support a school in Philadelphia, a maritime charter school, and that's where we have to be touching. That's where we have to be reaching. It's not going to solve itself quickly, but it needs to solve itself, and we need to be focused on doing that.
Well, I am so excited just to let you know. Tune in to my next podcast. I'm going to do a special episode on We Work the Waterways. It's an industry outreach program, and you get to hear all about what our vision is, what we're currently doing to reach those students from multiple touch points all the way from elementary into high school. So definitely tune in for that one. I want to hit on this real quick.
You're doing a podcast without me?
It's just a bonus episode.
Oh, okay. All right. I don't feel so bad now. I felt jilted there for a minute.
I do want to hit on this real quick because I'm super excited. In September, IRPT is having our annual conference. And just to remind all of our listeners, we have members all around the nation and divide them based on the river they work on. And so we call that their basin. Each year, the members in each of the basins get together for free just to collaborate and talk about some of the challenges, but more importantly, strategize on the solutions, whether it be river management, whether it be economic development, et cetera. And then every year they all converge on one city. And this year it's in Memphis, Tennessee. We're celebrating our 50th anniversary. So all basins converge. Get on the website and learn about how you can be more a part of the event. It's going to be a fantastic celebration of 50 years with education, exhibitors, and more.
And I'm sorry, I'm going to miss that because I have to be in Hawaii to teach one of our marine a managers program out there and stuff. But I'm finding that one of the things that has happened post-COVID is that much more attendance at various conferences and everything. We've just set up a ramped up a new course in Baltimore in August. We've got one in Everett, Washington in September. I'm doing one in Hawaii. I'm doing one in New York. And Los Angeles, LA, Long Beach in December. We have a new program that we're setting for Australia. We've got one going off in the islands, which are the international program. And un programa en español con un instructor that speaks español, which is great. I'm really excited about that one. And we've been touching base. So the thing is I'm very happy to see that we're getting more people professionally trained. They're attending conferences, they're learning about things. And of course, when you get a good turnout at a conference and stuff, you get a lot of support for that, a lot of these activities. And those political folks we were just talking about, they begin to pay attention. They
That's
begin
right.
to say, oh yeah. And your conferences are great. You get like 300 people come to this to your conference plus,
Yeah.
400, I mean, it's great. And I'm going to be interested in seeing all your guys in black tie and baseball caps at your gala dinner. But unfortunately, I won't be there.
We'll send you pictures.
Okay, that works for me. So,
Well,
well,
thank you for joining us today. As always, my friend, it's great to see you and talk with you about the just everything happening in our industry, and I look forward to our next episode.
yes, and it's always a pleasure to see you and as well. I always learn a lot about the inland rivers every time we chat and everything like that. And it's always been very fascinating because we have the Inland River courses that we do and stuff like that. But there's a lot of activity over there as a result of the stimulated grant projects and everything. And that's wonderful. And great to hear that Robert Maxwell got a good grant down there. He's a good guy. And that's a great port. So
And congratulations, just to end the podcast on such the happy note, huge congratulations to our podcast producer, Tessa, who just was accepted into law school at the University of Mississippi.
Well, good. And I'm excited about that because I really think that I need to get her to come up to the Northeast and practice law up here with us. Besides, it's always good to have a lawyer sort of in the family because then I know who to call if I get stuck in jail.
Watch out, world. Here she comes.
There we go. Absolutely. Good for
Thank
you.
you again.
Thank you, everybody. And thank you for joining us. And we'll look forward to our next conversation.